it's amazing to me that this thing that I do and that you do, making books, that it is this wild human thing that is so powerful.
This is Heart of the Story, and I'm Nadine Kenny Johnstone. I'm an author and a holistic writing coach who talks with today's top women writers about how to navigate life when things don't go according to plan. These impactful conversations and personal reflections invite you to be seen, feel supported, and ultimately fall back in love with yourself. So let's go together to that honest, powerful place, the heart of the story.
Hi, friends. Today, I am bringing back a beloved conversation with best-selling memoirist Molly Weisenberg. You may have heard me chat recently with Hallie and Molly about our upcoming retreat that we are leading in Spain, and it's almost sold out. So if you would like to join us, you can head on over to the link in the show notes, and you can find it on my website, NadineKennyJohnstone.com. Please make the leap. This is your nudge. I'm so delighted about this retreat. And so I figured if you wanted to really get to know us on an even deeper level, I should bring back my chat with her that I had last February. That was really the start of what is now a really beautiful friendship. I had taken an online class with Molly in the fall of 2024. And loved her teaching style so much that I was like, I want to be involved with everything she does. I have really, really high standards as a teacher. I went to graduate school not only to learn how to write narratively, but also how to teach creative writing. So because I've been trained, and since I started that program in 2005, over 20 years ago, I have been teaching. And so I am very picky about the teachers I study under and work alongside. They really have to have an impact in a way that I really like when they use published models for inspiration and they break down craft elements and then they get you writing and then they get you trying new and experimental things. So it's a high bar, and Molly surpassed that by far. And so, as I said, I was like, let me just be involved with everything she does. And after that class, I reached out to her, asked if she would be willing to be interviewed on this podcast. She said yes. And I got to chat with her about all the books that she's written, which I had devoured every single one when they first came out. And so it was a delight to chat with her about her writing process. And in particular, we spoke about The Fixed Stars, which is her latest book. And it was one of those life-changing books for me. I remember exactly where and when I read it and why it had such a big impact on me, not only as a person, but as a writer too. And so we got to talk about what it's like when you write something that is totally different than anything you've written before, and you're really nervous about how it's going to be received, and you are getting really vulnerable on the page, and it's pretty damn scary. And so in this chat, we talk about putting all of those fears on the page. Why not call them out? Why not write about the actual writing, what it's like to write some really hard things and all the emotions that you're going through? It was really a pivotal moment for my own writing because it inspired me to take all of these anxieties that I was having and put them in written form. And we laughed a lot in this. She is, as I am, going through lots of fun midlife-y stuff. And so we got to have a great time. And this is indicative of how we are now as we have really developed a collaborative friendship. And now we'll be leading this retreat together in Spain in October. And I've really been working with her ever since that first workshop I took with her. And so I'm really, really grateful to be teaching alongside someone whose writing and teaching I greatly admire. Without further ado, here is my chat with Molly Weisenberg.
Welcome, welcome, Molly.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here and talk with you.
I have been looking forward to this for quite a while. And there's so much I want to talk with you about, but I think I'll start kind of at the beginning where I was exposed the most to your work. And this was back in 2021. I picked up a copy of The Fixed Stars, and it instantly became one of my all-time favorite books, and I will tell you why. 2021 was a wild year for many reasons, but my husband and I sold our house, and our son was maybe 8 at the time, mm-hmm. and we decided to live life on our own terms, and we bought an Airstream camper and went on the road for 3 months, mm-hmm. and some of which I would recommend, some of which I wouldn't. Like, 3 people, 2 dogs, and a betta fish in 27 feet. You know, it's like, could be good or bad. But we went on the road. I left my full-time writing professor position, and I just didn't know what was ahead, but I knew that I wanted to live life on my own terms. And mm-hmm. then I picked up your book while we were on the road, and I loved it because of following this narrator as they live life on their own terms. Mm-hmm. And that narrator is you.
It is.
So tell anyone who hasn't read Our Fixed Stars or The Fixed Stars, maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit just about the storyline.
Yeah. I love hearing your own connection to it, because there was a part of me when I was writing it that worried that my own story was so specific, as all of our stories are, that that it might find a very narrow audience. Because mm-hmm. so what the book is about is, about 10 years ago now, in the summer of 2015, I was selected for jury duty, and I developed a crush on a female defense attorney in this trial. And I was married to a man, had been for nearly 10 years at that point. We had one child. She was not quite 3. And I was really blindsided by this crush. And it wasn't that I was surprised to have a crush. It was that it felt completely, it felt overwhelming, and it felt like it made everything else in my life seem untrue. Like that the life I had been living, and the things that I had written about, I had already written 2 memoirs at that point. Everything that I had written suddenly felt was thrown into question, because I suddenly felt that I didn't know myself. And the book follows the couple of years that, you know, spun out from that time. My husband and I wound up trying to make some changes to our marriage to accommodate me getting to explore the things I needed to explore. And we wound up splitting up. But more than anything, the book is about trying to live with a self that isn't a fixed thing, and trying to trust myself anyway.
Yeah, there's this quote from the book: "I am the one I have to live with for the rest of my life. Only me." Mm-hmm. So talk to us a little bit about that self-trust, because I feel like many people are in a partnership, a job, a place, something, and it's they discover something new about themselves. They desire something different. And yet, because pursuing that desire will create changes, they tuck that thing away and they don't pursue. And that causes great strain in and of itself. So maybe tell us a little bit more about the self-trust and the self-discoveries that happen along the way.
I think that, you know, what you're describing, people having a certain desire or urge for a change or to try something or to live differently. I mean, I think that is more common than not. And I think that it is something that most of us feel compelled to tuck away. Yes. I think that this world does not make it easy to change tack once you're on a certain path. For me, you know, I spent a lot of the time period covered by the book not really trusting myself, but feeling somehow compelled to almost behave as though I did, because it felt to me that if I wanted to hold on to myself, this thing that was changing, if I didn't want to throw myself away, I had to follow what that self wanted, even if I didn't fully trust it, or even if I was afraid of it. And I think that for me, for better or for worse, the fear of losing touch with myself is greater than the fear of what might happen if I take a risk. And, you know, I think that there have been times in my life when, you know, when that has made it hard to compromise or to allow myself to do the kind of bending that we need to be able to do in relationships. Even as I've always been someone who loves being in relationship, I am now on my, I'm 5 years into my second marriage and plan to stay here forever, hopefully. But my urge to preserve myself, even when I'm not sure what that self is and what she wants, has always been a guiding force for me. And I guess I do at the bottom of it feel somehow that I can trust that even when the path isn't clear. I don't know if that makes sense. That feels very abstract.
No, completely. And it shines through in the writing. I think that's why I felt very engaged with it. And this, you know, Glennon Doyle talks about just not abandoning oneself. So this preserving of self, even when you don't know what changes lie ahead. I think, as you mentioned, it's hard to do in partnership. I'm constantly battling with this. My husband and I have been together for almost 19 years now, but we met when I was 22, you know, and I'm a very different person now than I was then. And so we're constantly trying to figure out how do we grow and morph individually and yet maintain a partnership, and hopefully that partnership also grows and flourishes. But how do we hold a container for each person to be able to explore their own selves and desires? So I'm wondering how that looks for you now, maybe in your current partnership.
You know, it is, gosh, it's so different this time around. So my spouse, Ash, they are non-binary, but they were, you know, assigned female at birth and raised as a girl. And I can't tell you how different it is to parent and keep house with mm-hmm. someone who, for better or for worse, was socialized female in all the good and bad of that. I guess underneath it all, I think what makes this partnership feel different to me, though, and feel like one that I can grow in, even though, of course, there are periods when you know, it's hard enough just to keep paddling along. I think what makes this relationship feel really different to me is that at the end of the day, I feel deeply understood by my partner. And I think that in my first relationship, I think I didn't even realize that I didn't feel deeply understood by my partner, right? I felt very understood. I would not have said that I didn't. But I think that I feel that in this partnership, I am fully able to, I feel like an artist in this partnership in a way that I didn't in my first. My ex-husband and I were together for 12 years, and we met when he was 23 and I was 26, and we met out of a shared love for the arts in many ways. He was a composer. I was a fledgling writer, and all of our friends were artists and cooks and things like that. And yet at the same time, I think that the demands of what I believed about heterosexual marriage and the demands of the life we ultimately built together undermined my sense of myself as a writer. And so what to me feels like it creates space within my marriage today is that even though my spouse Ash is not an artist in the way that my ex-husband is and was, even though Ash is profoundly creative and talented, I should say, what feels really different is that at the end of the day, Ash recognizes that there's a separation between who I am in our family life and my writing. And they recognize that even though it sometimes inconveniences our family, who I am as a writer is fundamentally who I am. And they help me protect that. And therefore, I feel that there's all this space for me within the relationship. And I think they do too. I won't speak for them, but I hope they feel as seen or understood by me as I do by them. But wow, it's crazy how much, you know, how much learning we've done just in the past 8 years together. I can't even imagine what I'll be able to say when we've been together for 19 years, like you and your husband.
Wow. Thinking about the support of you as a writer, I'm wondering what, and I'm just thinking about the writing part of it, what it was like for you to write The Fixed Stars, how it might have felt different writing than writing Delancey or A Homemade Life. What was it like with the writing process of that book?
Gosh, The Fixed Stars was so different. The process of it was so different. I love that you asked about it. With The Fixed Stars, I got to go away for long periods of time or relatively long periods of time. I think I spent, over the year that I was writing that book, I think I spent about a month away from home in a borrowed house writing. Which isn't a long time for a writer. I think that, you know, there are all kinds of writing residencies and things where people go away for a minimum of a month at a time. But given that I, when I was writing The Fixed Stars, I had a 6-year-old, it felt incredibly different to be able to go away for a week at a time, multiple times that year. And part of it, I have to say, was the beauty of shared custody, being able to have portions of every week where I was 100% not a mother and could really be a writer. And also it made it easier to take full weeks when I was not parenting and when my ex-husband had our daughter. So that was hugely different. Even though, you know, with my very first book, I was not a mother at all. And with my second book, I was pregnant. I just, I know that you're also a mother. We have our, my oldest is about the same age as your son, I believe.
Yeah, he's 11.
Yeah, June is 12. I just think that the perspective of being a mother and of being able to claim time for myself with this book and knowing how vital that time was, I just felt that I could like live into all the corners of that time in a different way. The other thing that was really, really different for me with this book was, although there were elements in both of my first two books, there were elements that frightened me, elements where I worried about how choices that I had made or certain scenes would be received. The majority of the fixed stars, I was never not aware that the story I was telling might alienate me from the readership I had built up thus far. You know, my first two books were food memoirs. The first one was very much about losing my father in my early 20s. It was very much about home cooking. My second book was about opening a restaurant with my husband. And then this third one is this very queer book and this book that cites a lot of other writers and that I was becoming a different writer as I wrote it. And I was interested in different things, but I was very aware of the risk I was taking. And if anything, I would say that really emboldened me to try to make a book that was even more sort of solid somehow, that could stand on its own and that I could be really proud of, a book that had a different kind of rigor to it. So I read a lot more when I was writing The Fixed Stars. I'd never read in my whole life as much as I did in that process. And that changed me tremendously. I can't imagine going back to not reading that much.
See, I know that people listening will probably want to feel emboldened, and yet many of them, writers, feel terrified to put their truths out in the world. So the reading helped embolden you. Was there anything else that helped you claim your story and be able to put it out into the world, overcoming any fears or critics that might have taken over?
I think that something that I grappled with throughout the writing of the book, and that writing the book helped me find some peace with, was, well, I think I was terrified that people would think that everything I had written up to that point was a lie. Because especially, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but I started working on that book in 2017. And there was not nearly as much conversation then as there has been in the years since about queerness or bisexuality or sexual fluidity. We didn't have so many examples of women in particular having partners of different genders throughout their lifetime. I mean, now it seems very commonplace. I don't know. But I think the voice in my head when I began writing that book was, people are going to believe that everything I've told them up to this point was a lie, that I was closeted. How can you write two full memoirs about, or written from the life of a heterosexual woman, to then write this like very queer book? And it was only through writing it and really writing about that fear the way that that fear was putting pressure on me from the outside, but also the way that that fear was inside me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if everything I've known about myself was a lie? What if I've been closeted even to myself? Mm-hmm. Really allowing myself to write that fear.
Yeah.
And to find ways to transform that fear into language and into art, this thing that could live outside of me and that I could make sentences about,
mm-hmm.
really helped me work with it. I know that sounds really simple, but I think often when there's something that I'm afraid will be received badly or that I won't be understood, my inclination is to begin right away sort of defending myself or mm-hmm. Issuing a rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, like taking myself one step backward, writing about that very fear and how I was grappling with it enabled me to sort of like externalize it and get some traction with it.
Mm.
So yeah, that's something that I think I challenged myself to do in the Fixed Stars, this sort of like level of meta analysis, like mm-hmm. what do I want? What am I afraid of? And how can I actually work with that within the story and not ignore it or shove it down?
Yeah. I think it was one of my most favorite things about the book was the peek into the internal questioning.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about it that felt so human and welcoming and encompassing. It's like, oh, other people grapple with the same internal rot thoughts and questions mm-hmm. and fears. And it felt very, very welcoming. And I just loved following it. I mean, your scenes, your written scenes are so powerful. And yet at the same time, I just love the exploration in the mind. And so for writers listening to it, it's also such a good takeaway that if the critic is in your mind and you have some worry or fear about what the reader's going to think and this and that, you can make it part of the writing. This mm-hmm. this internal processing can be part of what you write about.
Mm-hmm.
That way it's not this thing you shove in a corner and you hope that no one thinks or looks at.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, yeah, that noise in our heads, we get to choose what to do with it, right?
Mm.
And the poet Ocean Vuong, he, mm-hmm. On some podcast interview, he said that he always tells his writing students to make every choice.
Mm.
You know, whether it's like, you know, choosing a particular word or, but to make, you've got so many choices when you're writing. Make every choice. And I think that we can choose to write our questions or to sort of hide our questions. And I don't mean that in a bad way,
mm-hmm.
in the story. That's one approach. Or we can really just bring them very overtly into the text and grapple with them there. And and I think that sometimes we forget that we have a choice about mm-hmm. all these little parts of our story.
Mm-hmm. And in a class I took with you in the fall, you said something, and I'll paraphrase it. I won't be able to get any kind of quote right, but it was something that was very reassuring to me. So you were talking about almost as soon as writing is out in the world, of course, there's a desire to revise or edit because we change along the way. And yet sometimes our writing can almost feel like a timestamp, like, okay, like this is what I thought then. And then a reader coming to that now who hasn't experienced my growth since then will only know this version of me. And so you were talking about how one of the ways to kind of look at it is, yes, any writer who has something out in the world might want to revise and edit right away, even once it initially comes out in print. It's like we have a desire to go back, but we can look at that differently and we can think, knowing that I'd want to go back and change also is an exhibiting that I have grown, that I have grown as a human. And wow, that's a great thing. It's a good thing I am a different person than who I was when I wrote that. So really, it's a congratulations almost of self-growth. And you've said it very differently and very eloquently, but that gave me great reassurance because my first book I wrote primarily when I was 29 and 30, and it proclaimed a lot of things that have shifted for me now. And then my other book came out 2 years ago, and I already feel different than who I was when I wrote that. And yet it doesn't have to erase. We don't have to, even though we are different now, it doesn't have to erase what we thought at that time. And so I just wanted you to know that when you talked about that, I now look at things differently in terms of like, oh, because I might write that differently now shows that I have grown as a human being.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. I think it's something that I try to say at some point in every class because it's been revolutionary for me as a writer to try to shift that, I think, instinctive shame, maybe is the word for it, or embarrassment when we look at our past work. I mean, of course, we're going to wish we could change big parts of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was making a recipe the other day that I had written about on my now defunct blog in 2015. And oh gosh, I was looking at this this little essay I'd written, and there were so many elements of it that I didn't like, but I didn't actually have any real feeling about it. I was like, well, yeah, that was like 10 years ago. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's make this cake and we'll just, you know, it's fine. Mm-hmm. And that is not something I could have always said.
Yeah. One last question about writing, and then I want to talk about a totally different subject. But you're a teacher, a fabulous teacher. And I find, I don't know if you find this too, but I find that I teach and coach in a way that is what I would crave as a student. And so sometimes I find as a teacher and coach, okay, how do I maintain my writing practice? How do I infuse it with the same vigor and energy that I hope I give to other people? How do I give that to myself, essentially? How do I give that to my own writing? And so I'm curious about the ways that you invigorate your own writing and prioritize your writing, especially when you pour so much of your energy into teaching. Mm.
Oh, let's see. I mean, this is a question that I think I would answer in a way that is very specific to this period of my life. And if you asked me a couple of years ago, or if you asked me 2 years from now, it would be very different.
Yeah.
I used to really feel, I think, especially when I first started teaching, I used to feel like a real fraud because I didn't do any of the things that I had always heard you're supposed to do, you know, writing every day. Each of my books has been at least 5 years apart. Mm-hmm. I don't always have a project in the works. I'm not someone who is overflowing with ideas. Mm-hmm. I was watching a documentary last night about Jim Henson. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, the guy had so many ideas. And I was like, what is that even like? I just am not someone who, I don't have a lot of ideas that I can point to and say, ah, oh, there's an idea. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you, especially if you are teaching something, you look around at your peers and they all seem like they're full of these ideas all the time, these concepts and names for things and brands and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, one thing that's been nice about having children, and we now have a two-year-old who my spouse gave birth to, has been that the pressure that it puts upon my time forces me to truly, I can't lie to myself about the kind of writer I am or the kind of writer I'm going to be. My life has very limited compartments right now for writing. mm-hmm. as opposed to teaching. I also have a podcast mm-hmm. and then parenting a young child. Yeah. And so it's kind of stripped away for me that sense that I should be doing more writing mm-hmm. or that I should be moving on to another book. It's like, no, this is a very temporary period. I'm 46 years old with a 2-year-old and this too shall pass. But, you know, I would say I get maybe 10 hours a month to write. Mm-hmm. To be mm-hmm. perfectly honest,
yeah,
I teach a lot and that does give me a tremendous amount of energy, but it does not give me that kind of writing energy. Mm-hmm. And what ultimately does at this period in time is the awareness that I notice within myself when I've gone too long without writing. I truly mm-hmm. feel mm-hmm. I'm not somebody who needs to write or who wakes up each day wanting to write, but I notice a growing like pressure, like under the surface mm-hmm. when I need to sit down and write. And I always feel so much better afterward. And that feeling better carries me along for a couple weeks until I carve out another period of time in which to write. So mm-hmm. becoming more aware of my own rhythm mm-hmm. and honoring it, saying like, oh, this is because I need to sit down and write.
Yeah.
Or, hey, I actually, there's something I want to write about today. Mm-hmm. In the past, I think I would have let that slip away or might not have noticed it. And now because I have to be so intentional with my time, I do notice it. Mm-hmm. The other thing is reading.
Yeah.
Nothing makes me want to write as much as reading other people's work.
Same.
And I read primarily fiction in my sort of non-work life. I'm always reading a novel. And then I love reading other people's essays and things online, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. especially when they're weird or when I can really tell that somebody has just followed their own weird thing.
Yeah,
it gets me really juiced up. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's not a lot of time for writing. I was just telling my sister yesterday, people love to ask me if I'm working on a book. And yesterday I noticed when I replied to her that no, I wasn't, that for the first time, I didn't feel bad about it. Mm-hmm. Like just for that moment. Tomorrow I might feel bad about it. But I was like, no, I've got a lot going on and I am thrilled that I can manage to find some time to mm-hmm. write like every other week.
Yeah.
Which would be, I think, horrifying to a lot of writers. But to me, that sounds okay.
No, it's fabulous. When I was talking to Maggie Smith on this show, she was talking about how, you know, people forget that there were like 10-year spans between yeah. her first couple of books because she was at the time a mother of young children. And, you know, people ask her nowadays how she's able to do so much with her books and her Substack. And she talks about just the different seasons of life. Like, okay, it's very different to be a mother of older children who are mostly self-sufficient and one has more time. And we have to recognize the season that we are in as writers, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very wise.
You've talked about what you read in your Substack is where I discovered a recent talk that you gave about Miranda July's All Fours. And then also on your Substack, I read and saw your interview with Catherine Newman, who wrote Sandwich. And a lot of what you show that you've been reading about and talking about is midlife stuff. Mm-hmm. 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 In all its juiciness.
Yes.
Tell us what midlife looks like for you.
Let's see. So yeah, I'm having this really interesting experience of being the parent of a young child again. Mm-hmm. Our kids are 10 years apart and I was the birth parent for my daughter, who's 12, and that was in my first marriage. And my spouse was the birth parent for our son, Ames, who is, turning two. Well, when we're recording this, he's turning two in about a week. So physically, it's interesting because I did not expect to have these particular like demands on my physical body. I noticed the other day my knees are like kind of rough and bruised from like kneeling on the floor all the time, like changing diapers and like crawling around, like trying to wrangle somebody and put his shoes on. Like I think I didn't expect to be doing that right now. But at the same time, I would say that I feel physically stronger and more bold in my body than I did when I was younger. I grew up in Oklahoma, which is I don't know if you ever watched like Friday Night Lights. Did you ever watch it? Okay. Well, so like the football culture, the sports culture is really strong. Very similar where I grew up to Friday Night Lights. And when I was growing up, there was, I think I had this idea of what a good body is or a useful body or a strong body that was very much rooted in sort of Midwestern aesthetics and in sports. And I was a pale redheaded kid who wasn't good at sports. And I think like a lot of women have discovered, I wouldn't call it athleticism, but have discovered a certain like facility or like a certain ability within myself that I couldn't have recognized when I was younger. So dancing is really important to me at this particular season. I'm not getting a lot of time to dance, but there's a dance sort of exercise thing that started here in Seattle called Dance Church. It's sort of like going out dancing, but in a like a dance studio. And it's very sweaty and it's very loud and it's great. The woman who started it has done an incredible job of expanding it to many different cities. And anyway, but that was a huge part of my life through the time when I was writing The Fixed Stars and up really through early COVID. So dancing radically changed what I thought my body was capable of. And then I, at the age of 43, I think, returned to horseback riding, which was something I had done as a teenager, but I think had always been very fearful about. And I still am fearful. I'm not fearless. I've fallen off once since I started again and I got a concussion. And I was like, Okay, I could really get hurt here. But I love it so much. And I can't believe my body remembers how to do it. And it feels incredible to rediscover these things about myself. So in many ways, I feel stronger and bolder than I did before, even as I'm also aware that my body hurts and my hair's going gray, which I actually really like. My skin feels dry. And but I also remind myself like, oh, well, I'm only 46. Like, God, I probably barely even know what I'm talking about. So I feel like I'm, you know, really just beginning this big life shift. But it's incredible to find myself emboldened in my body, at least emboldened for me, if not by anybody else's standards.
Yeah. Dance has been a big, big thing for me as well. A few years ago, I went to a retreat that was led by this beautiful intuitive painter, Flora Boley, and she incorporates dance into the retreat. And I'd grown up as a little girl doing ballet and tap, and this was very different dancing. And I remember when I was in eighth grade and my body just felt so awkward and foreign to me, I tried to go back to dance, to a dance class, because I wanted, something in me knew that my body needed to express itself. But I went back to Darla's dance studio on the south side of Chicago, and it was like all ballerinas who had been in ballet for now years. And I was this like pubescent adolescent with an awkward body. And I immediately felt like, oh no, okay, I guess this is not what I wanted. And so back to Flora's retreat, we were dancing just in a way that we, it was like, what does your body want to do right now?
Yeah.
And this was a whole new thing for me. And I came back from that retreat and I started dancing so much more in the house, and our son dances with me all the time now in the kitchen. And when I have the house to myself, I'll put on like 90s music that I used to love growing up, and I'll just dance and dance. It is a rediscovering of what I used to love, and also a remembering of what my body can do and wants to do. And there is something so empowering about it that I love.
Mm-hmm.
So as you've been reading these different women writers who are talking about midlife, how is it impacting you?
I mean, I feel very lucky to live in a time when we are talking about female midlife.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I should also say that it's amazing to me how quickly the conversations change, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, 5 years ago, we weren't talking about it, or at least not like we are now, right? Mm-hmm. And I also love that the way that these things get brought to the fore culturally, at least recently, has been through books.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly, I'm sure there have been movies and things too, but Miranda July's All Fours, Catherine Newman's Sandwich, a number of books that have come out about divorce, Maggie Smith, Leslie Jamison. I love that I'm living in a time when this is being talked about. I've always been drawn to talking about and writing about the things we're not supposed to, I say that with scare quotes, not supposed to talk about, because I feel compelled to talk about them.
Yeah.
Like, I remember a big risk in writing my first book was I had not planned to write about the scene of my father dying. I'd not planned to include that in the book. And partway through writing it, I felt so deeply back in that time. I felt that I had to write that scene. And I kept thinking to myself, like, this is a memoir with recipes. I can't write about like the color of my father's skin as he was dying. People don't want this in a book where I'm also giving them a recipe for blueberry raspberry pound cake. But I felt compelled to do it.
Yeah.
And so in the same way, I love that we can now, I mean, you and I started our conversation this morning before the mics were on, talking about the length of our recent menstrual cycles.
Yeah.
And I want to live in a world where we can talk about these things.
Yeah.
It, like, there's nothing about the body that is shameful. And this is something I have to tell myself all the time. I'm learning how to believe it.
Mm.
I feel tremendously freed, and it helps me accept my own physical experience when I see other people, other women in particular, writing through these experiences. It's amazing to me when I think about how few of us really get the privilege of writing books. It's amazing to me the impact that what we do manage to get out there can have, the reverberations through a culture. I mean, like Miranda July's All Fours. Certainly not all of us are Miranda July, and we don't all find that kind of success. But it's amazing to me that this thing that I do and that you do, making books, that it is this wild human thing that is so powerful.
So powerful. So powerful. Yeah. Catherine Newman's Sandwich was one of my top books of 2024. And just her talking about the reproductive
lives like that we live and all the iterations that we go through, seeing other women write about how they're feeling and what they're thinking, I think it is an immediate shame shrinker because all of a sudden I go, oh, thank God, somebody else is thinking that thought, is having that desire, is having anguish over this, is wrestling with that. Thank goodness it's not just me. So it's first, it just takes the shame down. But then it just, as a writer, opens me and I realize, oh, I get to write about this.
Yeah.
Actually, I get to write about whatever I want to write about. And it is a permission granter. Mm-hmm.
I had – so Catherine Newman has written a bit about her colonoscopy. And,
and you wrote about your colonoscopy.
I should also give real credit to Anne Helen Peterson, who writes the newsletter Culture Study. She's the first person I saw write really directly and unsparingly about the experience of a colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. That emboldened me. And oh my God, it was so much fun to write about. It was so fun to write about my colonoscopy.
I loved your like detailed timeline that you gave.
Yes. No, I kept it in my, you know, my notes app on my phone because I was like, well, I know I'm going to have another one of these in 5 or 10 years. So I might as well like remember what I did that worked. And then I looked back at it and was like, oh, that's so fun. I'm going to write about this. I'm going to take this thing and explore it.
And it is so funny because, you know, because the conversation is so much more open about perimenopause and midlife and so many things. When I started my Substack, one of the first things that I wrote about very briefly, though, was how I'm supporting my body through perimenopause, which I entered earlier than I thought I would be entering. I'm 41. And yet the craziness of my cycles and my hormone panel, everything is like, no, well, you're here. And so I was writing about it. And then I'm like, my cousin John in Ireland reads this. Does he want to be reading about this? Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, cousin, I guess you'll get to know me on a deeper level here.
Well, and the thing is too that, no, I mean, I remember when I was first writing a blog, this would have been in like 2005.
Yeah. Orangette?
It was Orangette.
Yeah.
And I remember a friend had given me some sourdough starter, which at the time seemed like so exotic.
Yeah.
And I was trying to learn to bake with this sourdough starter. And I baked a loaf. And I don't know what had happened. It, you know, something weird had happened in the shaping of the dough. And basically, when this like round loaf came out of the oven, it had grown like two appendages in the front. It looked like, I don't know, like it had two back legs. It looked possibly like a really diseased phallus. Like, and I thought this was very, very, very funny. And I remember I wrote about it and somebody in my family reached out to me and they told me that it was really inappropriate and whatever. I mean, it was sophomoric and whatever.
Yeah.
But I think now about like how different the conversation is. I mean, it was a loaf of bread that sprouted like a scrotum. And, you know, these days somebody would like make a meme about it. And that's one thing, whatever. But I feel so grateful to, I guess, to have now all these years, more than 20 years of writing out of my own experiences under my belt and to feel less easily shamed or silenced by following my own whims and certainly my own thermometer for what is acceptable has been altered too. But whatever, it was fine. It was fine.
The sourdough scrotum. So as we wrap up, what is something that you're feeling pulled to explore in your writing, whether it be something exciting, something that feels a little risky? Where are you being pulled towards?
Well, something that I did in 2024 that felt really risky or really challenging to me was I reached out to a novelist I really admire, and it felt like a real stretch, and I asked if I could interview him. And I interview people sporadically, maybe a few times a year on my newsletter. It's not a huge part of what I do. And in general, when I started doing it, my intention was to reach out to people I knew. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I remember I was terrified, but this writer I really love, his name is Garth Greenwell. He had a new book coming out. And I thought, okay, well, I'm sure he's receiving lots of interview requests. I'm gonna try this. Yeah. And for me, it brought up all kinds of stuff about fears about my own intelligence or ability to hold my own in conversation with him. Mm-hmm. But I did it. And then I had this date on my calendar and I knew I needed to prepare for it. Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, all the work that sometimes goes into interviewing someone, listening to other interviews with them, reading their work, et cetera, et cetera. And so I spent hours and hours preparing for this interview and wound up having the most wonderful human time and also getting so much, both as a writer and a teacher, out of everything I learned from just preparing for that interview. And so I would say that something I feel really drawn toward, both for my writing practice and for my teaching, is continuing to challenge myself to reach out to and connect to and have conversations with people whose work challenges me, mm-hmm. or maybe even intimidates me. I have a couple people in mind for 2025, and I feel really nervous, but I also know that that nervousness is, that it's something I have to move toward. So I'm really excited about that and what I will glean from doing that work.
Mm. And it's so worth it. I had a similar kind of goal last year. I was like, I want to reach out to Abigail Thomas. I want to reach out to Maggie Smith, like people I've admired for years and years. So I do what I call brave days, and I put them on my calendar. And on that day, I have to do the brave thing and just do the ask, like come hell or high water, I've got to press send. And I'm always terrified on my brave day, but it's like, it's almost like the brave day is in a vortex that doesn't exist in reality. And I just have to be a different person on that day. And I just press send. It's mm-hmm. like, la, la, la. I didn't even do it.
Uh-huh. Well, and then
they say yes.
And then you got to have a whole lot more brave days, like to get to the day when you interview them, which so is the biggest brave day. But yeah, there's something about committing to this particular kind of challenge that, you know, the challenge of something I want so much.
Yes.
And that I know I have to sort of live my way into.
Yeah. And then you do it, like you said, and it's delightful and you mm-hmm. glean so much from it and you think, well, why didn't this happen sooner? You know, mm-hmm. I can't wait to listen to that interview, actually. It's on my queue. Thank you, thank you, thank you for this interview. This was delightful. If I could have tapped myself in 2021 on the shoulder and said, guess what? You'll get to chat with Molly in 3.5 years. I wouldn't have believed it. So thank you.
Oh, that is so kind. I loved it.
Oh, I loved this conversation. And I love that Molly and Hallie Bateman and I are leading that retreat in Spain that I talked about at the top of the episode. Truly, it's going to be magical. So if you're thinking about it, definitely sign up. There are only a couple spots left, and I want you to be a part of this magical experience. So go to the link in the show notes or check it out on my website, NadineKennyJohnstone.com. Special thanks to my dear producer, Michelle Rado, for all she does for this incredible show. And remember, everyone, every heart has a story, and every story has a heart. See you next week.